here we are again. It's another How Bette Davis Saved My Life. Time for fun with Bette's ladies. I'm Moya.
And I'm Georgia.
And we are so excited today. We are doing Dinner at 8. I hope you've been enjoying our podcast. And if you have, please hit the subscribe button and anticipate all the goodness that we will be bringing into your lives via Old Classic Hollywood. We are here to assist you in letting classic Hollywood movies be your life coach. Isn't that right, Georgia?
Yes, Moya, because we think that movies make life larger. They just add such a richness to your life and help you gain a perspective. And so there's so many lessons to learn, and we're going to be presenting those to you whenever we have you tune into our podcast. So you're going to learn and you're going to enjoy.
Yes, ma'am. So our movie today is Dinner at 8, 1933. Dramedy, just absolute perfection at the height of Hollywood's powers. The 30s and 40s are my personal favorite era of the classic Hollywood era, if you will. And this is exactly one of those renderings that made classic Hollywood classic Hollywood.
It sure did, Moya. And, you know, there was so much that really made this an amazing movie. This had an ensemble cast, which I think was probably one of the finest that they could have put together, not only at that time, but probably one of the best in all of motion picture history.
Oh, definitely, definitely. We had Jean Harlow, Marie Dressler, the Barrymore brothers, Lionel and John. Billy Burke. Am I leaving anybody out? I probably am.
Did we mention Wallace Beery?
Yes, Wallace Beery. I know I was leaving someone out. And so those were like the top, the A-listers, and they had a supporting cast that was very capable as well. And these people were people who you had seen in other movies, you know, in different combinations throughout the 30s and 40s.
One of the things that I like about this movie is it's, to me, is like a time capsule because it was very timely. And when you think about what's going on right now, I think it also kind of hits a nerve too. Because there, you know, the themes in this movie. The dialogue, the directing, everything is just crisp. It's perfection.
Right.
But you know what's so amazing to me is, well, you know, I like it when I was talking about time capsule, if you look at it, look at the sets, pay attention to the lovely 30s Art Deco styling and the costuming. And especially when you look at what Jean Harlow is wearing, you'll notice in a lot of 30s movies, you'll see a credit that says Gowns by Adrian.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
So she's wearing this gown that she looks like she was just poured into.
Oh, and took the words right out of my mouth. Yes, yes.
She had these like motion picture stills that were taken that were for publicity purposes, and it looks like she's poured into this stunning white satin gown. It's cut on the bias, and she wears that to the dinner party, and it became such a fashion hit at the time that the style became known as the Jean Harlow dress.
Oh,
and so
yes.
If you ever see any pictures of it, you will notice there is a white satin dress. And I think she also at times has a fox fur with it.
Yes.
And it is absolutely stunning. And then, you know, it really complements, you know, her platinum hair, you know, and why you can understand that she was called the blonde bombshell.
Right.
So
right.
Pay particular attention to that when you see it.
So the dress that Georgia is referring to is in like the last part of the movie. And Georgia took the words right out of my mouth. And so there's a funny scene where Jean Harlow's character, Kitty, says, "Oh, no, I can't be out in the sun. If I expose myself, I just, you know, it just wrecks my skin." And she turns and faces, because all you see is the front of the dress. then she turns and faces her back to the camera and to us to get a drink off the from the butler, and her back, like, you could play tic-tac-toe on her back. Like, you could have, you could show the movie on her back. It's completely nude, completely exposed, and it is absolute. So Adrian is one of my favorite classic Hollywood designers. I do believe I have a book. There is a book, and I think I have it, strictly about Adrian's designs. And he designed for everyone. I mean, the man knew a woman's body. He knew how. And so, and yes, we're going to park a minute on the fashion, y'all. We got to do it to honor the Adrian. Because there are several different body types. And Marie Dressler, we're going to talk about her, the grand dame, you know, in this movie and in Hollywood. You know, she's a larger woman. And he, doesn't he dress her? I mean, gosh, I'm sorry I didn't see who did the makeup because I'm just so into clothes. But Marie Dressler wasn't the best looking woman in the world. And a lot of her movies, you know, that's a running joke. But the way Adrian draped her in the fur game, oh my gosh, the way he draped her in these furs and the way on her arms, because she has some meaty arms, okay, and the draping over the arms and such with the cutouts, just perfection. You could wear these clothes today. Couldn't you wear them today, Georgia, and be perfectly in fashion?
Oh, my. Yes, they're timeless. They're absolutely the personification of elegance. And like somebody who knows and loves and appreciates the female form.
Right.
Yes. I would, if I had the figure, I would wear that in a heartbeat.
Oh, yeah.
And people, and you know, that's like the kind of thing that you look at and you just drool over. I mean.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Absolute. Just gorgeous. Gorgeous.
Right. And so that gown, so the fashion, whenever Adrian does a movie, and I'm sure Georgia can attest to this, whenever he does a movie, his fashions are like another character. So of course, Jean Harlow, like Georgia said, is the blonde bombshell. That was her, you know, her nickname. And so everything she has on, because she's in the movie, she's very sexual and sexy, and she's a temptress and a vamp. And, but she also has this childlike character as well. Excuse me. And so Adrian, when he dressed, so when she's in the bed, when you first see Kitty, excuse me, Jean Harlow's character, she's in the bed and she looks like she is just a Barbie doll stuck in like a bale of cotton, like in a cloud. She is like in a cloud, a Barbie doll in a cloud. The clouds are her, in the wind are her clothes. And okay, wasn't that bedroom everything? It would look like the inside of a child's jewelry box. It looked like a jewel box,
yeah.
Even though it's in black and white, but wasn't it so lush?
It was fabulous. Yeah, you're right. It was lush. It was just luxury, just luxe. I mean, it was the white, and you're right. It was like she was on a cloud, and it was such a contrast to her character, because this is a woman who is extraordinarily self-centered.
Right.
And she's lower class, but she's got all these trappings around her. You know, she and her husband have just, you know, come into wealth. And, you know, she is like, she's got these bonbons and she's like taking a bite out of one and then like tossing it, taking a bite out of one and tossing it. I mean,
right.
Her mannerisms give you an idea of what this character's life, like, even though they just dress her and all this, they surround her in this luxury. And I think that's such a contrast, because you can see her character does not really match up with her clothing and the set design or anything.
Yes.
It does not. I mean, so it really brings out, you know, this character is, you know, a lower class person. And so when you get into the movie, you'll see that. But her acting is really good.
She really
does that role so well.
Jean Harlow, you know, a lot of people say she couldn't act, but I never had a problem with Jean Harlow. I love her in everything. In the movie Bombshell, where she kind of spoofs herself, and again, the clothes are killer. I never thought she was all that good looking. Like they said, I think that everybody said she was more sexy, and she was, but it was like a childlike innocence sexy where men loved her and women loved her. You know, it wasn't the type of sexy that put the women off, you know, because sometimes you have those type of broads. But she was a very likable vamp and the rhymes with King Tut. Tut, you know, another word starts with an S, you know, not the king part, the Tut part. But you liked her, you know, and like they said, Jean, I've heard that, you know, a little trivia, she was kind of loose in real life, but when she got committed to a man, you know, and she really wasn't loose, that's not the right thing. When, you know, look, it's Hollywood back then, just like it is now. You're young, you're beautiful, you're gonna meet and greet. But you know when she got with, you know, William Powell and her was supposed to get married when she died with when her untimely death. She was so young, she was married before. So when she got with a guy, she was with him. But there were rumors, you know, that said she was, you know, she could be very wild, and I even heard she swung both ways. So who knows? You know, these people aren't here to defend themselves. But as far as on film, she was the perfect bombshell, a perfect pre-code sex symbol who gave you everything, you know.
You know, one of the things that really interested me about her in this movie was that she got along well with everyone except for one actor, and that was Wallace Beery. And so their real life, and he didn't like her either. And so I think the way in real life that they disliked each other, I think helped them play their roles very convincingly because they are really going at it tooth and nail. I mean, when she says something to him, she doesn't say it. I mean, she hurls it at him. She throws it at him. She will be insulting, and then she'll talk like a little baby. She'll say, "Oh, the big beautiful house," and then she'll go and she'll be like a shrew, and she will just tear into him. And they both do. But I mean, but she really was very convincing, I think, as an actress in this. And Marie Dressler said she did really great, and she and Marie Dressler admired each other so much. Marie Dressler said, you know, she did so well she could have stolen the movie, but Jean Harlow purposely held back a little bit to let her also shine, to let Marie Dressler also, you know, do what she needed to do to be noticed. But I think one of the things about Marie Dressler is she seems to be such an unusual pick for this role, but she shines in it. I mean, she went out like, I think this was her best role, because when she started this movie, she was recuperating from serious cancer surgery. And you know, the shame is that she died of cancer in 1934, very soon after this movie was released. And but I just love the way I like the character Carlotta, or Arlotta they call her. And I like the way she was because she had this wisdom about her, and she still had this grace. And you know, it was each character in this movie really reflects what is going on at the time, because the Great Depression has been going on here, and it's affecting all these people who have money and power and status. And so each one is hiding something in this movie, or they've got a problem that they're dealing with. And that's what makes this movie so interesting, so timely, and so rich in the way they bring out the characters. And also, it's so plot driven.
Oh,
And
yes.
one of the things about this movie I thought was interesting that the director George Cukor did was he shot this movie in as close to chronological order as he could, so that the actors could feel the dramatic power of these climactic scenes. And so I think that was a really interesting way to shoot the movie, because you know, a lot of people think that that's how movies are shot. No, they're not. They're shot totally out of order. And you know, they're shot like, if there's all one set on one day, you know, they'll do all the scenes in that, you know, and then with one character, they'll do all the scenes with that one character, whatever. But this was shot in chronological order, and to make the characters really evolve and move with their characters and the with what's actually happening in the plot.
Right.
So just keep that in mind when you see this movie.
So let's park it there, Marie Dressler, because her character, I could relate to her a lot. I'm 45. I'll be 46 soon. And I could really relate to Carlotta or Lotta, like you said. So she is a former stage siren, was a huge star apparently in her day. She was a former love interest of Lionel Barrymore. They revealed in the plot that she was about 10 years older than he was when they met. He was in his 20s and she was in his 30s. And of course, she probably was his first love. And of course, she was too hot to try it, as they say, because she was the bee's knees, honey. She had all the men falling at her feet and she couldn't be bothered with this little young, you know, clerk, you know, so she spurned him. But she told him in a scene that, you know, she went home and cried when she dumped him because, you know, now you're a older woman and you have no one basically to call your own. And all you're left was the shadow of your memories of you and your, you know, your youth and your heyday. And she figured out too late, like a lot of us, that he probably was the one for her, you know. And I kind of couldn't relate to that because even though I'm very happily married, but, you know, you always think back to Lotta says something that men were her work. And, you know,
Yeah. She's
down on her luck, too. You know, she has a little money, but she's not where she should be because, like Georgia said, because of the depression. It's a total reversal of fortune. People who were laborers and scrappers for money, they no longer have money. Excuse me, y'all. This weather's changing around here. But anyway, and Wallace Beery, you know, he comes from humble beginning. He was a miner. Now he, through, you know, reversal of fortune, now he's on top, you know, getting paid. And now Barrymore's character and who's Oliver Jordan and Lotta, Marie Dressler's character. Now they're, you know, they're struggling. And so Lotta comes to see Oliver, Barrymore's character, Lionel's character, because, you know, she wants to sell some stock and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, they reunite and they, you know, like anybody who old friends, you go over old times. And I said, I can relate to that as a woman, because I'm like, had I not used the sense that God gave me, you know, and not married my husband, I could so see myself, Georgia, playing that scene out with my husband, because he obviously was the best choice for me. And you know, women, like I said before, man, we have an expiration date on us that not just the people in the aisle can smell, the whole store can smell your expiration date. When you're a woman of a certain age, you know, good luck trying to, you know, turn them tricks again and get you somebody. And I'm not saying it can't happen, but it's just very difficult. What do you think about that?
Yeah, Moya, I would have to say it struck me the same way as it did you. You know, one of the things that I thought was kind of sweet about this movie was that they still retained, you know, this affection for each other throughout the years, and even though he was married to this woman who's this like really flighty socialite person, but yet she was still grounded. And you know, you feel bad for her because she's struggling. You know, she can't maintain the lifestyle that she used to have entertaining people, and
right,
she's, you can tell, you know, she's like, she's got some of the stock in his company, and she's saying, you know, it looks like I'm gonna have to sell it, and I really don't like, you know, what do you think? And you know, and they have, and I like the way that the wife recognizes that this is an old flame. And I thought it was just very poignant to me that they mentioned somewhere in the movie that he proposed to her on his 21st birthday.
Right.
And of course she turned him down. But, you know, I thought there was something sweet about the way that they maintained this friendship and this obvious affection that they had for each other. And here she's gone on to fame and, you know, fame and acclaim and all the trappings that come with it. And now that she's an older person, she's on hard times. And I just felt like, and she spoke with such wisdom at different times, and she would have some great lines that they would give her in this movie.
Yes.
I just thought you hardly ever see a role like this for a more mature woman.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like Moya pointed out, she doesn't have, like, you know, the bombshell body or the face and all that, but she is just about the most winningest. She is one of the winningest characters in this whole movie because of the way she, you know, she gives advice when it's needed. She doesn't poke her head in. She's, you know, I just really love her character, and I felt so badly that she didn't survive very long after this movie because
right.
I thought here is such a great role for a great woman, and she went out on a high note, and that's one of the things that I love about this movie.
Oh, definitely. And one of the reasons why Georgia and I picked this movie as well, because you've heard us say in other podcasts and other episodes rather, you know, we try not to pick women's movies or, you know, movies that's just women oriented. And Dinner at 8 is not that, don't you think? Don't you think it's a mixed crowd, mixed audience type movie, Georgia? Men can relate to this about the struggles with business and money and trying to keep the family and being the leader. And then women aging and youth versus beauty versus brains. Don't you think? It's a mixed bag.
It touches on so much, because when I was watching this movie, I was thinking, you know, you have, like, in present day, you have, like, corporate business takeovers, like somebody who's trying to, like, you know, be underhanded and take advantage of you and your business. And then, of course, like all of us, I mean, we have been feeling economic pressure, which you see in this movie. And then I saw, like, you know, like we were just talking about aging and fading careers. But even though it was a drama and a comedy, it touched on infidelity,
right,
love, divorce, alcoholism, even suicide. I mean, this movie spans so many really contemporary, very relevant issues, but yet it does not bring you down.
It's amazing. It does not. You are so right about that. Amazing.
But you know, in this movie, Moya, you know, I look at these people and how they interrelate with each other and the serious problems that they're kind of, you know, dealing with and that they're hiding. And you would think that all these people with all their money and all their power and prestige and wealth, you don't think of them as having such serious problems, but they do.
Right.
And some people are more sympathetic than others. Some people I didn't have much sympathy for. Other ones I did. Okay. Some of them I thought,
Well, who? Who did you not have sympathy
you're
for?
You're a rotten person.
Who did you not have sympathy for?
Things on yourself.
Who did you not have sympathy for?
I did not have sympathy for Dan Packard, played by Wallace Beery.
Okay.
I did not have any sympathy for him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because he was trying to ruin to his event. He was trying to, like, he had that, like, fake name that he went by, and he was trying to say, oh, that person's going to buy up his stock. And he was trying to, like, go to Washington, D.C., and I thought, I don't have any sympathy for you that your wife is cheating on you, that your wife hates you, you're in a loveless marriage. I don't feel sorry for you because they think you're a terrible person. You know, he talks about wanting to go to Washington and influence the president and everything. I was like, no, Wallace Beery, I don't feel sorry for you. But then again, I also didn't have too much sympathy for, and maybe you'll disagree with me on this, but the John Barrymore character,
mm-hmm.
The actor.
Right.
But, you know, what a lot of people said about him was that the character that he played was a very close resemblance to his actual life because he battled with alcoholism and his acting career was declining.
Right.
Because you have to remember that the Barrymores started out in the silent movies, and now that the talkies were being made, a lot of people's careers had declined.
Yes.
And they would never go back to the former glory that they used to have as actors.
Right.
And so one of the things in this movie you know, is like, here he's like this serial like philanderer and cheater, and he's trying desperately. I mean, he's like practically starving. He's destitute. You know, he's one of the people invited to this dinner, and nobody seems to be aware that he is having an affair with the daughter here of
the Olivers.
Yeah, the daughter of, yeah, exactly. And they don't know that. And he's trying to, like, break up with her and saying, you know, I've just, you know, been through all these women and you don't want to, you know, stay with me. And the daughter is, she's extremely young. I think she's like maybe 19, 20, something like that.
Yeah, she's 19.
She's like, no, no, I'm going to give up my fiance, you know, and all that for you. And the thing is he there's some scenes in here that are just kind of, that really illustrate how bad it is. I mean, he's practically begging for a role in this movie, and they want to give him just a little teeny tiny bit part. And, you know, he tries to, like, get the hotel, the people at the hotel tell him that he can't stay there anymore, you know, because he hasn't paid in a while. And you see him on this downward spiral here.
Right.
And he can't even, like, he's not successful in getting the bellboy to hawk or pawn some of his things for him, you know. And so, but did you notice, like, in his final scene, like, because they call him, like, he's the profile, how he turns his profile in that final scene. And I was like, oh, my goodness. It just really, it wasn't until, like, I took a second look at that that I realized, you know, what was going on. And so that's just, you know, that's part of, that's not, but let me tell you, that's not how the movie ends. So it doesn't end on a down note at all. It does not. But this Barrymore character, I wanted to say, because before I had mixed ideas about his acting. I always liked Lionel Barrymore's acting better, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah,
me
too.
But then this role, I thought, man, he just really, really makes you see the bad side or the downside of the character, and also you do feel some empathy for him, even though he has brought all of this on himself. You still kind of feel, you know, not you just really kind of are hoping against hope that somehow he doesn't go through with it. At least I did anyway.
I totally agree with you. I think so. Let me just back up. So Dinner at 8, and it's called Dinner at 8, everybody, those of you who haven't seen it. We highly encourage you to look at these movies. Again, hit the subscribe button. We're on Facebook at How Bette Davis Saved My Life. And talk to us about these movies. You know, if you agree or disagree or whatever, we want to continue the conversation. And for those of you who've never seen it, Dinner at 8, because the dinner that's at 8 p.m. is where all these characters are going to converge. All the plot lines and storylines are going to converge. And it's dinner at Billy Burke's and Lionel Barrymore's character, the Olivers, is at their home. And like Georgia mentioned, Billy Burke's character, Mrs. Oliver, you know, she's a socialite and social climber. And, you know, she's trying to throw this party so she can be down. And, you know, and everybody's like, oh, to the Oliver's home and blah blah blah, and doesn't quite work out for her, and it's hilarious. And I do apologize for my voice. But that's why it's called Dinner at 8. And throughout the movie, you'll hear a gonging of a clock to let you know what time of day it is, that is getting closer and closer to this dinner. And as each gong goes, the story evolves, and it's just really masterful storytelling. But to go back to what Georgia was saying, excuse me, about the characters, and especially these women, do you feel sympathy for any of these people? There's a doctor who's having an affair with Jean Harlow's character, and the wife. And I'm not going to give my opinion. The wife knows and has known that this doctor has had affairs. She was with him when he was on a come up. And what I like about these scenes, they're not long, drawn out scenes with these long soliloquies and these long speeches. There's such realistic poignant, to the point, concise conversation that tells you everything you need to know about these characters. Don't you agree with that, Georgia? That there you were looking at it. It is what it is. Form your opinion and move on. It doesn't preach to you. And I love that about this movie. But what do you think about this wife and the wives that stay with cheating husbands? And so before I say whatever, my piece, I want to know, what do you think about this wife in the movie and just that in general?
You know, I had a hard time squaring with her. She was so sweet and loving, and yes, she stuck by her husband. But at the same point, you know, she talks about the first time she found out or figured out that her husband was cheating on her. And she was about to have a baby, and it's almost like her whole world just crashed and ended. But yet she keeps going on, even though there are more and more affairs that he's having. And I thought, you know, this is not the role model that I would ever advise any of my friends to have or to be. Because
I like how you so diplomatically put that.
I thought that he should not have been able to have his cake and eat it too.
Right.
I don't think that he should have been always able to come home to a wife that would always forgive him, because there's a point to where you say, no, I think of myself enough. I don't think that is what was intended for me. It's not right that one person keeps their marriage vows and the other person doesn't. And that's the way I look at it.
Well, did you feel sorry for her?
Only to a very limited degree, because I thought the rest of this, you know, after the initial grief and the shock and to find out that he's doing that, I could understand that. But after that, if you continue to stay with him, he's continuing to do it. No, I do not, because that is your making.
Mm-hmm.
You have chosen to stay in that. So you choose the unhappiness that comes with it, because you choose to stay with this man and in this relationship and to continue seeing him do it. So at that point, I had to say no. At the beginning, the initial shock, because that's happened to a lot of women. You know, you find that out, that initial betrayal, and it hurts. Yes, I do feel sympathy. But if you stay on when it keeps going on, then no, I don't.
Well,
so that's my take on it.
I like your 21st century post-Great Depression era stance on that. your high horse, your independent woman high horse that you're I like that, as they say. I mean, look, who knows? And I'm saying that with tongue in cheek, because again, it was the Great Freaking Depression. Women, not a lot of women had their own money or careers. So even though the movie did not get into that as to why she stayed, obviously she loves this man, and he loves her in his own way. So, you know, for whatever that's worth. So I try to not look at some of these movies, Georgia, through the lens of today and try to understand. I do agree with you on the woman said it. She said, like the Sade song, love is stronger than pride. You know, she said, I have no pride when it comes to him. So, you know, and it was played by Karen Morley, the wife, and I love her because she would play a total rhymes with witch character in some of her movies, and then she would be the innocent victim. So she didn't get a lot of credit, really unknown and unsung actress, Karen Morley. So I try to give them a break, you know, because it's so easy. Because I would say exactly what you're saying, but again, it was a different. And the divorce, people did not divorce like they do now. It was a scandal,
yeah.
Especially if you were in society, because he was a big society doctor. You just did not. It wasn't good for business. So you know, you and then kids, people stood together for children. So, you know, I try to, you know, keep those factors in mind and not, you know, be too hard on them. But, girl, I can't. Today, would I put up with it? No. A lot of women do, even though we're light years from the scenarios of how women were back then. But a lot of women still put up with it today. I don't know why. But they may still feel that they're in that that 20th century, 30s era mindset where you don't divorce, and because of the reasons I just gave. So I just wanted to get your take on it before I harped on that. So let's talk about, you mentioned, I think his name was John Laurent. That's John Barrymore's character's name, the washed up actor. And if my memory serves me correct, and again, George and I are not the Bible on this stuff, I want to say because John Barrymore's alcoholism, his real life alcoholism, played a role in the movie having some hiccups, because he would have to be sobered up to do some of these scenes. So he may very well have been actually drunk in some of these scenes, but they had to do several takes because he couldn't remember his lines or whatever. But kudos to him and everybody in production, because he gives a tour de force performance. I'm with you. I prefer Lionel Barrymore. I prefer Ethel Barrymore, the sister. But John Barrymore, he was the screen idol, the sex symbol. But he could act. When he wasn't doing too much over-the-top stuff, he was a very good actor. And I just want to comment on that scene where he bursts into tears. Girl, that was just heartbreaking for me. I felt something for him. I did feel sympathy for him, because like a
Yeah.
lot of people in show business and in real life, you believe your own hype. Meaning that you believe what's written about you or said about you, where these people are just blowing smoke up your butt to keep their hustle, to keep their job going. And this clown actually believed his hype. He didn't go to work, do his job like Spencer Tracy said. I go to work, I hit my mark, say my lines, and I leave. That's how I am in my real life, whatever jobs I have. My job does not define who I am. It is a way to get paid, and that's the end of it. And unfortunately, in Hollywood, people, that's their identity, and that's what happened to this guy. So, girl, when he burst into tears, Georgia, I thought that was one of the best cinematic moments in history of just pure anguish, in my opinion.
Oh, I know. It was amazing to me how he could just really, I felt the emotion. I felt it. I thought, man. Now I know why the Barrymore name was just so commanding in the early years of cinematic history, and he pulled this role off.
Yeah, he
He
should have
really
gotten an
did. But like I
Oscar or
said,
something, a nomination or
and
something. I don't
like
know
you
if he
touched
did.
on, it came from a place
Right.
that was real, you know. And when I was watching it, I thought, oh my goodness,
Right. It was tough.
man,
It was
It
tough.
really mirrored his own life, I thought, and so that's why one of the things that just really impressed me about the casting of him in this
Right,
role,
right.
because they had other people in mind for some of these other roles, and so that impressed me quite a bit.
Well, what about him? Go ahead. No, go ahead.
But Moya, what really surprises me about this movie is like, it was all the great acting, the directing, the writing. This movie, as you would expect, it did good at the box office. It was a good success with the audiences and the critics. And but this movie did not get any Academy Award nominations,
Wow.
none whatsoever. I can't understand that. I researched it. It didn't get any.
Maybe it
Zero.
hit too
None.
close to home. I have, girl, who knows the politics that goes into the Oscars, but no, you're right. It should have gotten something. That's crazy. No,
Yeah.
was just going to comment. So the other female in this movie that someone may find herself relating to is that idiot 19-year-old. And that's like an oxymoron, an idiot 19-year-old.
I know.
But I call her idiot because even though she was 19, I'm like, 19, my eye. I'm like, the broad is 25 and she's a date. But Madge Evans
Oh,
plays her.
yeah. Oh,
So
yeah.
she, and she was heavily made up. She had the 30s look, so whatever. But she's supposed to be 19. And what pissed me off with her, because the guy is telling her, and so, okay, I'm gonna get extra real right now. Me and my other friends have had these conversations. Men, Men, and again, feminazis, feminists, put your fingers in your ears. Men, non-slimy, non-con artists, men who really don't have an agenda to destroy you, put it like that. They are brutally honest with you because he kept telling her in so many words, I'm just not that into you. I'm using you.
Yeah.
Let's have a good time. Let's enjoy each other. Your youth excites me. It gives me life. He's like a parasitical almost in a way for her youth. But he was telling her, run. Don't walk. Run away from me because nothing good can come out of it. And what made me mad with her and women like her, they don't listen. The man, and then they want to get mad with the man when he goes with another chick or he's ghosting her, meaning not picking up the phone or he's not answering a text, whatever like that. And he's no good. He's a jerk. He's a blah, blah, blah. But this dude, and I've seen this over and over and over. Not me, honey, because, you know, I was a man eater. Whoa, here she come. Watch out. She's a man eater. You know, I ain't do that. But like the other chicks who wasn't hip to the game, and they'd be crying, I don't know where Johnny is. And I'm listening, I'm like, this dude don't want you. Like, there's like 50 other cats. Just go around the corner and just meet and greet. But they would, and they just did not get it. And they're trying to put, a square peg in a round hole. And it burned. I could have strangled that girl, the Madge Evans, the 19-year-old daughter. Because she was like, I love you. Like, love will conquer all. And don't women fall into that foolishness? Love will conquer. My love. As if you walk on water. Girl, go sit down. Please, go have several seats here. You ain't nobody. This man is telling. And he was super old. He was like, he could have been her dad. He said he was 45. So he was between 45, 47. She was 19. Ew. Gross. Yuck. What was her? And I couldn't understand because her and Lionel Barrymore, her dad in the movie, they had a beautiful relationship. So she didn't have daddy issues. She just was so I'm leaving a part out. She had a fiance who was crazy about her. And, you know, she was going to kick him to the curb for John Barrymore, old broke down character self. And so, but she was Sister Hot. It rhymes with something else. But Sister Hot Pants. And so she thought, you know, she could work that thing. And, you know, and that's all that was, her ego. And I think it was interesting that her ego juxtaposed to his. She was, you know, trumping his ego, which I found hilarious. I'm like, you moron. What do you think about that?
I could not agree with you more about the way you characterized her. I just wanted to, like, do a share, like, snap out of it.
Right.
Like, somebody's got to save you from yourself. You know, I mean, it wasn't until she finally realizes he's killed himself. You know, I mean,
right.
What more could she, like you said, he spells it all out for her. You know, we had fun, you know,
right.
Like go back to your fiance, it's over with. She still won't accept it.
Right.
You know, and
right.
I thought, I mean, she is just, she will not take no for an answer. And I thought, oh, for crying out loud, you know, it really, you don't understand. It takes two people, like two to tango. If he says no and you say it's not going to work,
right.
Both people have to say yes. But it's not until Marie Dressler, who happens to be in the same hotel that they're staying in,
right.
And sees her leaving and knows about the affair, but
right.
Doesn't say anything. then it's when Marie Dressler finds out about the suicide, and then she tells her and says, sits down with her. And in the most, it's a very endearing, a very charming, but it's wise and it's firm. It's just
right.
Such a great scene.
Right.
She sits down with her and tells her, look, he's committed suicide, and honey, here, you dry your tears, make yourself presentable, but
mm-hmm.
you go in there and, like, you be with your fiancé,
right.
And you need to understand some things about life. The girl, this is like, you know, put on your big girl panties. You grow up right now.
Right.
And this is, there's somebody right here who loves you. who absolutely is crazy about you. Do you realize what you have here? And so I thought how fortunate she was to be able to land on her feet, you know, because in those days, that kind of scandal, they reported it in scandal sheets, and it would have been kind of like a real undoing for her. It could have ruined her future with her. I mean, and Marie Dressler is really helping her out here in her role. And I thought, wow, I mean, here she is. You know, she was a hero in that scene. She was purely heroic. I don't think that's overstating it.
Is she?
And so I liked that scene because
I love it.
That is like, you know, you have pivotal moments in your life where life gives you a wake-up call.
Right.
And she was like, she did this thing that her mother, her ridiculous Liberty Diva, that scene with Billy Burke's character, you know, just made me crazy because she thinks, and you've got problems, which I thought was hysterical.
Right.
Because her problem is just this society dinner that she wants to pull off and, you know, trying to find, you know, the right number of people. And I think at one point it's kind of funny. Somebody says to her, like, why do you have to have an equal number of men and women? It's not the end of the world. It's not for mating purposes. Yeah. Dinner's not mating.
Right.
You know? I thought that was hilarious.
Yeah. I want to go back to the Marie Dressler scene with the 19-year-old where she, you know, tells her what John Barrymore has done to himself. She said some words that I live by today. And, you know, she told her, talking about the girl's fiance, she said, he won't ever want to know anything about your past as long as you keep it in the past.
Oh, yes.
And that, so I saw this movie a lot of times, you guys, George and I, this is like my gosh, third or fourth time seeing this movie. And I see these movies in different stages in my life. And I saw this movie first, I was a little younger, and those words resonated with me. And then it kind of echoed some words that my great aunt told my mom when she was younger. And my mom told me, she said, look, nobody needs to know what you did. She said, you come home, she said, you wipe your mouth, the lipstick off your mouth, and you get on with it. And I never forgot that. And it kind of echoes what Marie Dressler says. Because, look, I'm not going to be a moralist or whatever like that. Just ask the average man. I mean, a real man, not a little cat with low self-esteem and mommy issues or whatever his problem. But a real man who knows who he is. Just ask him if you want to finesse the situation. You know, is there a time you ever would like to know about all my boyfriends or any of my boy? And a real man will say, no. The man you dealing with who loves you, who holds you and go get your coffee or rubs your feet or you whatever, that dude don't want to know anything about that. And if you a real woman and you really care about your relationship and your future, I don't want to know about them other broads. Because what in the world does that have to do with not only the price of tea in China, but us right now? And that's what Marie Dressler, when she said that, and I don't know why, but you know what, Georgia? We live in a blabbermouth, like to go back to Ralph Cramden about Alice's mother, his mother-in-law. You are blabbermouth. Because these people now with social media, hey, they got to tell everybody all their business. And my gosh, you need to start treating people on a need-to-know basis. And that's what Marie Dressler was trying to tell this young broad. And that's why I'm harping on it right now. Because women, sometimes we are a blabbermouth. You put all that foolishness on social media, you try to take it down, it never goes away. Why does everybody got to know? I mean, girl, that's another phenomenon to me. Yes, I did get on my soapbox, but shut up. That's what I want to shut up. Shut up.
Absolutely. Keep the past in the past. She was so spot on with that advice that she gave her.
Right.
That was so wise of her. Oh, my gosh. That was really good.
And very kind of her, too, because I think Carlotta Lotti saw herself in that young lady, and she didn't want to see her make those same bad decisions. And she saw that young fiance that was John Oliver, that was Lionel Barrymore's character. Honey, you're about to blow it. If you don't chill and get yourself together, you're gonna blow it, you know. Let's see, we're kind of winding down here. Go ahead.
I have my favorite. This is one of the favorite scenes. I think it is so iconic.
Oh yes.
Okay,
yes.
And this is at the towards the end of the movie,
yes,
where they're finally all going in to dinner, and
it's perfect.
So Kitty is walking in with Lotta together, and you got to picture this. Okay, so here you have Carlotta, and next to her is Kitty, played by Jean Harlow, and she says something, well, and I think she's referring to the book that was out at the time. I think it came out in 1932. It was Aldous Huxley, Brave New World, and they're talking about this futuristic stuff. Anyway, so I think that's what they're referring to. And so anyway, so Jean Harlow says, I was reading a book.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, you see Marie Dressler, and it's just absolute perfection.
Yes.
She turns and looks at it like, she kind of stops in her tracks.
Right, right.
And she kind of does, like, and then she starts to stagger a little bit, and then she goes, well, it's all about civilization or something, and they say that all these, like, jobs are going to be taken over, or all these positions are going to be taken over by machines. And so she turns and looks at it, and she says something like, well, honey, you don't have to worry about nothing like that. And the way she does, it's the classic double take.
Classic.
The way she stops in her tracks.
Classic.
And it kind of staggers. That is, like, movie, motion picture history gold
right
there.
Right.
That scene is just...
Right.
It's hysterical.
Right. And whenever you see Dinner 8, they're always going to show that scene because, it's like you said, it's so iconic. And I also want you to notice something I noticed when I was looking at it again. Marie Dressler, and it's so real. She is comparing her bling on her arm bling to Jean Harlow's bling. So you got to really pay attention because as they're locking arms and they're going to walk in to have the dinner, she's comparing, she's looking down at their arms, and she's looking at it like, man, this chick is iced out, you know, and I guess I used to have that, or who knows what's going through her mind, or probably, what does she have to do to get that, you know, like that, and so, and then they go on to do the scene that Georgia is talking about. Again, everybody, this is, if you don't see any other Hollywood classic, especially from pre-code, the 30s, and when we say pre-code, this is before they Hollywood really start putting their foot down and saying, you can't do this, you can't do that, this is too sexual, this is too suggestive. And Hollywood really lost it, the teeth of movie telling and storytelling and about, and not just sex for sex sake, but just realism. So that's when we talk about pre-code, when they put the hammer down on that. But this, you have to see this movie because of all the reasons that we've said and some other reasons we probably left out because, you know, we want to keep our time frame tight. But yes, Dinner at 8, George Cukor, Adrian does the gowns. And so check it out. It is a classic Hollywood film that you can learn a lot from and get a life coach lesson from it, I think. So, Georgia, we're almost out of time. I'm going to shoot it over to you. Any last thoughts on Dinner at 8?
I just want to say there's a reason why Turner Classic Movies consider this one of their essentials.
Mm-hmm,
and
yes,
this is because of like what Moya just mentioned, the lessons in it, life lessons. But this movie is so, so good. It's perfection in the way it's directed, the writing, the pacing of it, the star power in it. I mean, this movie put Selznick on the map.
Yeah.
You know, he went on, as you know, to do Gone with the Wind. And
right.
So this is, or you're seeing all of this happening right here. I mean, people at the very top of their form. So that's why Moy and I give it such a strong recommendation. So watch it and enjoy it.
Yes, watch it and enjoy and learn, learn, learn. Pay attention. And thank you for correcting me. It was David O. Selznick, I said Cukor, who directed. Well, that is all the time
Oh,
we.
the director was George Cukor,
Oh, I'm
but
sorry.
it was produced by David O. Selznick. He was the
Okay.
producer.
I thought when I was saying that, I didn't think
Yeah.
that sounded right. But yeah, thank you. George is the head of our research department, so she knows all this good stuff. But yeah, so again, thank you everyone for listening in. Don't forget to hit the subscribe button. Hit us up on Facebook at How Betty Davis Saved My Life. Betty's Ladies is our handle. If you want to post to us and comment to us, we would love it. And we will see you next time. Again, we have no idea what movie we're going to do, but you know it's going to be another doozy. So I am Moya.
And I'm Georgia.
And we are out. This is How Betty Davis Saved My Life, Life Lessons from Classic Hollywoods. We will see you next time.
Yay, it's a wrap. We came in at right about 56 minutes.